foot enthusiasts, minimal footwear lovers, or anyone trying to fix your own feet, I'm heading to North Carolina this May to lead a live, in-person, three-day retreat all about feet. I'm going to be at the Art of Living Retreat Center, which is up in the mountains of North Carolina. It's so beautiful there. And are you ready to hear what I'm calling it? The retreat is called Healing Your Soul, a stepwise approach to building forever functional feet. That's so good, right? If you want to learn all about how to take care of the muscles, bones, joints, fascia, and nerves of the feet, and learn how strong feet and ankles relate to sustainable hips and knees, this event is for you. In addition to the classroom and movement time with me, you're on retreat. So there's delicious meals, a nature-rich campus that you can explore on foot, and plenty of time for rest and relaxation, all included. A retreat is a perfect way to care for yourself in the moment, but also in the future. You are coming to learn a massive toolkit of information. So whether you're a competitive runner, a dynamic ager, or a healthcare practitioner, this is a weekend full of movement for you and your feet. And like I said, you're gonna leave with a toolkit and a big swag bag that you can use to train your feet for life. For more information about the movement sessions, the food, the center, head to my website, nutritiousmovement.com/retreat. That's nutritiousmovement.com/retreat. It's the Move Your DNA podcast with Katie Bowman. I'm Katie Bowman, biomechanist and author of Move Your DNA and a bunch of other books about movement. This show is about how movement works on the cellular level, how to change your position as you move and why you might want to, and how movement works in the world, also known as movement ecology. All bodies are welcome. Are you ready to get moving? Hello, friends. This is the 10th episode in this short series of interviews I'm doing on movement. Specifically, the many ways people consider movement outside of exercise. I'd like to do a small shout out to Dr. Ihi Heke, who I interviewed in episode 99, whose sharing of his indigenous perspective on movement and health has been our most popular episode, according to iTunes. So yay! You can hear it in my voice. It's hoarse from just saying yay and expressing my gratitude just to everyone who listened and shared, especially my New Zealand listeners. I really appreciate you getting the word out about Dr. Heke's work. He is such an important voice in this movement. We're starting to tune in to other cultural perspectives, which is why I am excited to talk to Philip Brass today. He's a member of the Peipekasis First Nation on the Treaty 4 territory of Canada, for another Indigenous perspective on natural movement. But before we get there, I've got some questions on natural movement to answer. These are brought to you by our Dynamic Collective, which is a co-op of sponsors that includes Softstar, MyMayu, Unshoes, Earthrunner, and Ven Design, all companies that support some lifestyle element of natural movement, from minimal footwear, sandals, boots, running footwear, something to wear with your nice clothes, something that you can feel comfortable taking camping or backpacking for all ages, all seasons, to minimal furniture that includes sitting cushions and balls that allow more of you to move while you're just sitting there. These companies sponsor this question and answer portion of each episode of Move Your DNA, and you can find more about them in our show notes. So let me get to the questions. This one, for a little bit of context. I was recently in California, where I was doing a lot of swimming in wild spaces, which is what I love to do, but also in swimming pools. And I had posted a little bit about something that I talked about on maybe the last or the previous episode about how I get more movement in a pool versus just using the same strokes over and over again. I like to toss and dive for things into deep water so that I end up just naturally using a much broader range of strokes versus that same kind of swim team approach, which I was also on and loved, which is a lot of repetitive stroking. So it's just more natural for me to, I guess, choose ways of interacting with the swimming pool that don't require such narrow body use for, you know, a single stroke moving over the top of the water. So anyway, I posted on Instagram and there was a lot of discussion in the Instagram post. So I'll link to that post in my show notes. But there was this great question from Kate, and her comment was, "No way." I'm assuming she said it like that because she put a bunch of exclamation points. "No way." That's how Canadians talk. "I take my kids to the pool every week during the cold months and always think Katie wouldn't count this as movement because it isn't weight bearing. Am I wrong? I'm so happy to hear otherwise." So you can see exactly what I wrote back to her. But for those of you listening to this podcast, but I'm already here for the answer. It's like, of course, swimming is a natural movement. And I find it to be a critical natural movement skill, given the fact that many of us will encounter bodies of water in our life, and not only because it's fun, but because it can be life-saving natural movement knowledge, right? If we change the word skill to knowledge and to say, "I have knowledge of how to move through the water," then it's very important. Is it weight-bearing? No. Does all movement have to be weight-bearing? No. So I guess, as I explained to her, natural movement is a collection of many, many movements. So I would absolutely consider swimming to be a vitamin. It's just that right now, in a sedentary culture where we are picking and choosing maybe the one or two vitamins that we are going to consume, it isn't weight bearing. And so, you know, due to these laws of specificity and that we adapt to the movements that we do, you can get a ton of movement nutrients from water, but you can't get all of them. And so many people will use water as a therapeutic approach, not just children, but adults, because for those who experience pain when they bear weight, it's a way to allow them to continue to move. Again, it's fun. You can use water in many ways. You can certainly increase the movement nutrition, I guess, found in a bout of swimming by considering all of the ways that you use your body and what you're doing when you come to a body of water. For kids, I just would recommend, just like as maybe a nutritionist would, to make sure that swimming wasn't the only motion that was being done. You know, it's certainly better than nothing, and it's absolutely something to be doing regularly to build up that skill set. But I don't think that it replaces another movement nutrient. So that's my only commentary on it. Do I think it's awesome? Rad. Do I count it as movement? Yes. So am I wrong? Yeah. I would say that if you thought that I don't see swimming as a natural movement or something valuable, that's absolutely not the case. I would like to ensure that everyone had the ability to move through water in the best way that they can. So anyway, thanks, Kate. This next question is on feet and shoe size, and it's going to be brought to you by Soft Star Shoes, because speaking of sizing and footwear, my natural movement friends, you should check out their Primal Run Amok line. I got to be on their, I don't know what you call it. I got to see and assess and feedback on the shoes early on. Not as a paid thing, but just as they pulled lots of different people who work in feet, I guess, and shoes to ask for some feedback. And so I had my feedback and it was incorporated. And so if you have extra wide feet, check out these shoes. These are shoes with extra wide toe boxes, which is the part of the shoe that the front of your foot or your toes go into. You want to be able to have space to spread those toes. And a lot of people are writing me saying that they have really wide feet and cannot find something minimal enough in this regard. So check out Primal Run Amok at softstarshoes.com. So here's a question from Inez, who writes, "The last time I bought shoes, I chose one size larger than I have been buying in past years. Do you know whether increased foot mobility actually can lead to lengthening and expanding of the feet? Is that a thing? I've been doing the exercises from whole body barefoot and simple steps to foot pain relief, as well as walking lots more in general and in minimal shoes. And alternatively, could it simply be that I'm more aware of toe and wiggle space, such that previously I wasn't realizing my shoes were too small, but now I am? Thank you. And just so you know, your work is having an impact on my life." and obviously your feet, Inez. So thank you for this question. It's a great question. So I would say that it can be both. It could be that really maybe you hadn't been paying attention to what your toes were doing in shoes before, that your toes might not have even been extended to their full length before. Many people, especially generations previously where you might only get one pair of shoes a year when you're a kid, is a lot of people report that they learn how to shorten their toes or kind of claw their toes, which makes your whole foot length less because they did not like the sensation of bumping up against the end of their shoe, and they are obviously growing while they're wearing their shoes. So it could be that, yes, you have just now started to feel the way your toes are interacting with your shoes, and so you are buying a shoe one size larger because now that gives you the space. But also quite often people experience an increase in size of their foot. And so it's interesting, this idea of mobility seems to, again, in our minds, we hold it in a vacuum, which is like, oh, my toes just can go through greater ranges of motion, whether it's spreading apart or lifting up high. And that is true, but at the same time, it's also not happening in a vacuum, meaning if you have a lot of foot tension, the resting length of your foot is less. Also, when people develop strength in the rest of their foot, you know, they change the height of the arch. So like these, in Move Your DNA, I was really trying to call out, like, you are actually changing the lengths. You're changing the lengths of certain segments because you're usually measuring length along one particular plane. And so it's not that the bones themselves are getting longer. It's that when you start playing around with multiple planes of orientation, you will affect things like length. Same thing as height. I took my dad to the doctor one time. This is going to be a classic Katie Bowman aside. When I took my dad to the doctor, they measured his height and it was like, oh, you've shrunk an inch. He was 89. And so she was just quickly explaining that the volume of your discs gets less. And you know, that can be one case. And I said, also though, if you're not measuring how much farther forward his head or shoulders are, it can be that if your spine's just curling forward, your height is now traveling around a curve and not straight up. So since you're measuring height along the wall, it could just be that he's more forward. And it was kind of like a, what? And then I showed her quickly the math. Just by, if you just take a string and moved it forward, I said, you see his height, his segment length hasn't changed. He doesn't necessarily have shorter vertebral bodies, the height of the vertebrae themselves, or less mass in the disc. It's just all oriented in a different plane than what you were measuring. Same with the foot. So maybe that's the holdup, is like, could my bones be getting longer? Probably not. Could you have been, through muscle tensions, constantly, chronically holding your foot to a functional length that is different than what those segments of your bones allow? Yes. So anyway, you're welcome, Inez, for that long sidebar about this time I had with my dad. I just, you know, when people pass away, don't you want to talk about them all the time? I do. And when you combine that with someone who also wants to just talk all the time, there you go. Anyway, thank you, Softstar, everyone else in the collective, Unshoes, Earth Runner, Venn Design, maker of beautiful dynamic living space decor, and my Mayu outdoor boots for kids. For more information on these companies, go to the show notes, click listen, click podcast transcripts. They're linked on the top of the notes. And if you have a question, please send it to me via podcast@nutritiousmovement.com. I want to answer it. So let's do this. Philip Brass is a member of the Pepegasis First Nation in the Treaty 4 Territory of Canada. He is a dedicated husband and father and traditional knowledge carrier. He is a strong and emerging voice in the areas of Indigenous food sovereignty, land-based education, climate action, community health, natural movement, and traditional Indigenous knowledge and wisdom. Philip has been described as a visionary. He's a big thinker who possesses the ability to articulate the connections between the different systemic issues facing our world today and how traditional Indigenous knowledge offers many of the solutions. I met him when I was in Saskatchewan, Canada, last year, or maybe it was like a year and a half ago. We'll talk about it in a second. But first, Philip Brass, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you.
We were trying to talk briefly about how we met, and neither one of us can remember the name of the conference, but Saskatchewan First Nations, we believe it's the nutritionist.
Yeah, I mean, it took place at the Treaty 4 Governance Center in Fort Capel, Saskatchewan, and there was, I believe it was perhaps Health Canada. There was dietitians there from throughout the province, and of course, different First Nations staff, I think mostly health staff that were present about a year and a half ago. Yeah.
Yeah, it was September. So I guess we're like on the year and a half mark. It was beautiful. And so we got a chance to work together. And I'm just really happy that you are here for reasons I think will become obvious. You are really immersed in a lot of things that maybe my listeners here understand in a theoretical way, or they're trying to learn more about maybe their role in their environment. And I just think that your perspective, your work is so important. So I'd like to share it. So I guess we're going to start with like my first question, which is what does natural movement mean to you?
Yeah. And that's such a juggernaut of a question. you know, because I think natural movement really goes and affects all aspects of life. Whether it be our physical health, the health of our mental health, politics, you know, and our life practices every day in trying to find a sustainable path forward for future generations. So, you know, just on a practical level, as an individual, natural movement is something that as I'm aging and beginning to feel the aches and pains from my life, it's become very much of a conscious effort to go back to movements that our ancestors would have been familiar with, you know, finding just better ways to sit and or to squat and to walk. I mean, all of these different ways that we see the toll that sitting in chairs or our cars and what have you, or repetitive movement through industrialized working conditions, you know, and to see what that's doing to our bodies and doing to our communities and doing to our ability to maintain cultural health in our communities.
So I know food sovereignty is a big component of your work. How do you see natural movement relating to, I guess, food sovereignty? And I want to talk about, why don't you start with, like, what does food sovereignty mean to you? And then how does it relate to natural movement / Indigenous practices?
Right. Yeah, well, for myself, Indigenous food sovereignty is really recognizing just how important our food culture is to the overall well-being of Indigenous nations. I mean, we can expand that out to all human cultures, but of course, I spend my time as an Indigenous person focused on reclaiming Indigenous ways of knowing and being, recovering from the effects of colonialism here in North America. And, you know, in my journey in life, whether it be participating in our spiritual institutes and ceremonies, or whether it be in just some of our festivals, such as powwow or other aspects of culture, I've come to understand that our food culture really is the core. Mm-hmm. You know, people will say, you know, language is the foundation of our culture, where I would argue that it's actually our food culture that is the foundation, and it's that food culture that gave birth to our languages. Mm. So, you know, we see, you know, in language recovery of Indigenous languages, the language retention doesn't seem to really get traction when students are trying to learn that in a classroom environment. Mm. But when we put them back on the land, and when they're on the land, that usually always has something to do with food production or food foraging, because that essentially is how our ancestors spent their entire day, was in the pursuit of food. And so when we are on the land, we quickly begin to reconnect with a lot of those, the linguistic sort of metaphors and references that are all there on the land in our local ecosystem. So linguistically, our indigenous languages, they were emergent from our local ecosystems and from that life of food culture on the land.
Mm. Okay, so we're going to speak about language for a second. What does being on the land mean to you? Or what's a definition of that term as you're using it?
Yeah, well, I mean, that too is dynamic and huge. I mean, being on the land, I mean, in a modern sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, just in a modern sense, I mean, making a conscious effort to be out on the land and to redesign our lives in on a daily practice on where does our food come from? How do we value natural landscapes? Are we able to design our school schedules and curriculum in order to help support being on the land, being immersed on a regular basis so that we nurture sort of ecological literacy with our children? You know, and as an indigenous people, I mean, our relationship with the land is inseparable. And, you know, we don't have temples. Our spiritual interaction is so tied with what we'd call our spiritual grandfathers or grandmothers, the spiritual entities that are actually, they reside in the physical landscape, whether it be the rocks, the soil, the grasses, the plant medicines, the trees, all of these. We recognize that these have spiritual consciousness. And by immersing ourselves in it, we are able to gain contact and to actually have a reciprocal relationship of communication with that landscape.
Well, there's like an emerging idea that nature is a vitamin, you know, like, hey, kids need regular doses of nature. You'll see like forest bathing and these ideas that going out into nature, maybe we could also call that an element of being on the land. It's like the perspective of it is that it's a therapy, that it's something that now in your regular life, you can go take a dose of, take, you know, a little like 15 minutes of vitamin nature, etc. Would you say that you have a view of nature as a therapy or as something much different than that?
Well, I think that, I mean, of course it's therapeutic. It's essential to our long-term well-being as a species. I think, though, if we are only to take it in small doses, that's not adequate. It's not adequate for our well-being as a species going forward for centuries. I think already just our dispossession from the land over the last century is already having such dramatic and devastating consequences on our physical and mental and spiritual health. So to take half measures of saying, you know, let's just tweak our daily habits or tweak our school curriculum, I don't think it's going to be enough. Yeah. I think that we really have to look at making some drastic systemic change in how we live.
All right. So being on the land, then there's like a volume to it. And so it's not like just going outside and being in a green space. It also includes maybe having a portion of your dwelling, or as you said, this food culture is relating back to the land. So I want to talk to you a little bit. I mean, since it is therapeutic, now a lot of the work that you do is with, is it just boys or boys and girls, where you're actually bringing them, I guess, back into being on the land. So can you share some of what the process of it and what some of the outcomes you've witnessed are?
Right. Well, for the most part, it's only been with boys. I have done a little bit of work with girls from our local school as well. Took some girls the other year out on a fishing camp. The reason I work with boys is because there was actually somebody else in the community who specifically works with girls. Mm. Yeah, I guess I had the privilege, I guess, in my family. I had a father who was a scholar and a professor, but he had also grew up on land very much as a boy and had hunting and fishing skills. That was a very important part of our life growing up. I have one older brother who was 9 years older, who also taught me as I was growing as a young boy. And I really took to that. I always felt a very deep sense of belonging on the land, on the water. And so from a very young age, I thrived in that environment. And it was my first priority in life was to make sure that I was spending as much time being on the land and learning about my local environment and the skills that went with that. And then being the youngest in my family, I began to have nieces and nephews by the time I was a teenager. And so a lot of my nephews, I began to teach them as well. And that's, you know, a little over 20 years ago. So yeah, I spent a lot of time, many, many trips, hunting trips, fishing trips with my nephews. And then four or five years here living on Papikasis, I had the opportunity to begin working with the youth here in the community. I took a job as the community wellness coordinator, which essentially was kind of the portfolio of a sport and rec, but also drug and alcohol and gang prevention. Because of course addictions and gang activity is always a struggle in any community stricken with poverty. So my way of connecting with a lot of the boys who seemed most at risk was to simply approach them and ask them if they wanted to go hunting with me. And of course, they would jump at that opportunity. And as I came to learn, you know, 95% of the boys that I worked with didn't have a father figure in their life. So, you know, it quickly turned into some very deep relationships that I hadn't envisioned at the onset, but I built some relationships with some fabulous young men, and you know, they were labeled as criminals and as drug dealers and vandals and that sort of thing, but they were also very much social leaders and had carried a lot of influence in the community with their peers, and so that circle quickly grew. You know, word got out that Phil was the guy who, you know, jump in Phil's truck and you'd be off on some adventure for the weekend. We'd go, you know, hunting moose, or we'd go fishing for the weekend or something.
I want you to hear a little bit more of what this is like. So I'm going to play a clip of a radio piece made by Katie Sawatsky, who is a journalism student at the University of Regina in Saskatchewan, Canada. This first aired on her school's radio show, 2945. Katie tagged along with Philip and some of the boys. Have a listen.
It's taken lots of coaching, but, you know, the boys really learning how to work as a team because they have to stay in formation, right? Stay, you know, even with each other. If somebody falls way behind or someone gets way too far ahead, then the rabbits are able to find a way to cut back and get between them, right? So it takes a lot of cooperation. Nobody home. Off to the next bush. They're like a little pack of wolves coming through the bush here. And so that builds belonging amongst them. As Indigenous peoples, especially, I mean, it's this place. You know, our ancestors, we've been here for millennia. We have a deep spiritual relationship with this place. And it's a powerful force in our lives.
Good there, Bill. Yeah, just stay about that close to the edge all the way around. You going down the middle, Kiwana?
Yeah.
Okay. We'll wait here. We can have an open area.
You know, it's a smaller one.
And this is going to get real. It's thick and tangly, right? So it's going to be pretty tough for them going through there. You move slow, Tyler. You should move slow because Big Bill's going to have to go the fastest because he's going around the outside. In fact, Bill, you should probably be in the middle and let Kiwana be up on top because he's got longer legs to move quicker.
These things matter. Especially since we have been forcibly removed from the land for over a century. You know, I think, you know, it's the foundation of all of our social crises in our communities. When you can put young people back on the land, you begin to see the ripple effects throughout their life, right? And a lot of the negative social habits just disappear.
There's one right in between you and me. Keep your eyes open. It's right in between you and me.
If you want to hear more of Katie Sawatsky's radio documentary, you can connect with her on Twitter at KDOKESAWATZKY or find her on Facebook. I'll also link to her in the show notes. Here's more of my conversation with Philip.
So yeah, my circle of young men quickly grew. And then we also begin to involve ceremony. My role as a pipe carrier and a ceremony lodge carrier, I have sweat lodges and pipe ceremonies, other ceremonies we conduct here at our home. So begin to be able to involve the youth in that as well. And it's such a learning curve for myself in understanding the opportunity to learn while we were on the land. You know, there was opportunity to speak about some of our traditional values. For instance, as an example, there was a young man who was known for torturing animals in the community. He'd been known for having killed some cats and some dogs and that sort of thing in the community. And of course, he'd been confronted by it. I think he'd been in trouble with the law as well. But I befriended him, you know, and he was very rough around the edges. But I began taking him out with me. And what I found was that when you took these sort of tough boys who had a hard edge, you know, they were street tough, but they had no experience in the forest. They had no experience in a boat out on the water. And when you took them out of their comfort zones, they became very dependent and they were wide-eyed and very scared. And that then opened them up to receive teaching or to discuss some of the difficulties in their lives. And it also provided me with an opportunity to speak about some of our traditional teachings around the responsibility of our relationship with animals, the responsibility as a hunter when taking life, why you take life, when you don't take life, what are the protocols around acknowledging the spirit of that animal, what animals would you not kill. And so the roles and responsibilities around the procurement of food or taking of life of animals as something that this young man really grabbed onto. And I never let him know that I actually knew about his habit of killing animals. I just saw the opportunity, was able to introduce these traditional teachings in a neutral way. He grabbed onto that and he became the boy who was always teaching other boys from then on. He would be the ones teaching them about how to put tobacco down, how to pray, how to do these things. And as I realized, these kids, they were just starved. They're starved for identity. Hmm. You know, their identity as Indigenous people and what that deep relationship with the land is.
So you have found essentially community leaders and redirected them essentially back to being on the land and to some successes, have you seen?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, it's hard to measure success. I mean, I run into the issue of just capacity, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
sure.
I'm only one person, one individual. I can only spend so much time with individuals, you know, and that's the challenge, right? Because when you're dealing with, of course, youth who are living in poverty and in crisis, you know, you have to be available for them because they're constantly facing challenges day to day that are, well, sometimes derail any progress that you're making. But yeah, no, I think that just planting those seeds, you know, sometimes even if you don't see results in a year or 2 years, I mean, sometimes it takes many years, but you've planted a seed in somebody. They might have a hard road to walk for a while, but when you've introduced young people to a relationship with the land, I think that's something that they never will forget. And maybe at some point in their life, they're going to come back to it.
And I'm sort of laughing at my question. I have to apologize for my question about it's just such a my cultural and way that I've, you know, been trained to see the world. Like, tell me about the successes, you know, the fact that you were out there was the success. So again, I'm just gonna
right, yeah,
I mean,
sure.
I can just hear myself like, oh wait, that is my cultural bias is to not only value the moment by moment, but tell me about, you know. Tell me about the mass application of the thing. You know, so anyway, that was just, you know, Katie Bowman acknowledging problematic potentially element in her own way of seeing things. So thank you for so graciously responding to my cultural bias
We've all been hardwired to looking for results, right?
Well, exactly. I mean, yes. Thank you for being with me in that moment. I appreciate that.
No worries.
Anyway, I'm just trying to think of like so many different directions that I can go. So you have a young child, right? Is he five?
He'll be six on the 19th.
Yeah.
In a few more days. Yeah.
Yeah, that's just a few days after my son. So they're really close in birthday. And we were talking about, I'm not sure if your son attended, but that there were some, you know, we have a local nature school here, but you said that there was, maybe it was like, was it a Cree preschool where they were kind of creating like a, it was a way of introducing early language, but that recognizing that all the language is essentially centered, it's all nature-based language, right? Because what else is there if you're a nature-based people who, with the axis of your culture of being food, it's all going to be related to things that you eat and have to move through. So what would you like to see happen with that way of preserving language and also simultaneously relationship with identity and landscape?
Right. Yeah, well, this is the urgency, and it's a bit of a battle going on presently with First Nations. I mean, we use these different languages here in Canada. I mean, we prefer to, a reservation as a First Nation, and we don't usually utilize the word tribe. It's First Nation has become the sort of the politically correct term of the day. But anyway, around school curriculum, you have some First Nations throughout Canada who have had the ability to develop their own curriculum and implement their own curriculum in their schools, just because they've had the means and they've had the capacity in their communities to do so. I mean, if as a First Nation in Canada, if we draft our own laws, we have that right as sovereign Indigenous nations. But if we don't, then federal or provincial laws will take precedent. And what we're having now is you're seeing now is a big push by both the federal government and provincial governments to eliminate that opportunity for First Nations to draft their own legal frameworks and develop their own school curriculum, and to just bring us under the umbrella of the provincial school system and curriculum, which for myself is horrific because it's so the provincial system is so rigid and academically centric. And so for Indigenous communities, our needs are so fundamentally different than the mainstream society, where we're trying to recover or reclaim culture. So our educational needs are different. But yeah, making that link between language and land-based education and food education, I think is vitally important. A lot of people, even in our own communities, they're not making that link yet. I'm making these links because I've been involved in different aspects of that. You know, I've been involved with language reclamation, but I've also been involved with food sovereignty. But these two aren't talking to each other, right? Mm. And I'm beginning to connect these dots. I'm saying we need to stop putting these in silos because it's holistic. They all have to go together. But you are seeing some. Yeah, I mean, I've met others who have observed that and we're actually implementing that in their communities. I know the neighboring province of Manitoba, in northern Manitoba, they've been really moving forward with a lot of food sovereignty initiatives. At first, because of the expense of food in the north that has to be flown into these fly-in communities, so they began to get gardening programs, building greenhouses, bringing up all sorts of new sort of innovative little farming practices, whether raising chickens and all these sorts of things that had never been done way up in the north before. And they're seeing great success with it because they're also beginning to connect it with language, where they too were, beginning to see the loss of language in younger generations. So in this one community, they had language gardens. And so they had a huge garden at their school. And the older ladies of the community, who all could speak the language fluently, they were the ones who were also still had gardening skills. So they were running the garden. And the students would come out, and when it was that class's turn to work in the garden, it was Cree class time, and it was total Cree immersion in the garden. And they were able to see, we talk about results, monitoring results, the retention rates in language just went through the roof as compared to being in the classroom and trying to learn Cree.
language gardens. What a beautiful solution. I love that.
Yeah. And also with natural movement, right?
Well, I mean, it's all of it. It's out. I mean,
getting our fingers dirty.
Exactly. And just being outside is natural movement. You know, I think it's kind of been reduced to like sprinting and throwing rocks and squatting, but it really is all of the interactions with all that is in the natural world. And that just includes standing outside in a breeze. You know, that's definitely also natural movement. So I remember we were talking a while ago when we were together, and you had noted that your personal family has practices that kind of make you an outlier within your own community. Like you don't have a TV in your home, for example. And I would, as far as even hunting goes, like, are you an outlier within your own community because of the extent to which you are comfortable being on the land, or is it, have you noticed a change, you know, or how do you feel, I guess, having this knowledge or this understanding and wanting to expand it? How do you feel relative to the rest of your community?
Right. Well, I think I live a life of obscurity. No matter where I go, I'm a little bit of a different creature than the peers I grew up with. But and the reality of a lot of First Nations communities, I mean, and it varies widely. I mean, a lot of First Nations communities do have a very much of a homogenous sense of identity, and a lot of culture, traditional ways do survive. Where others, you can go down the road to a different community and it's going to be drastically different. And that's very much in the instance of my community. You know, I think the effects of colonialism, competing churches, religious institutions, and also just the influence of the television and pop culture has pulled our people in so many different directions into such different states of consciousness. And so it's very difficult to bring our community together and share a lot of commonalities that were there just two generations ago. And our grandparents, had a robust food culture in the community. Everybody was growing their food here up until the 1970s. You know, people had social relationships built around helping one another, whether it was canning food, hunting together, fishing together. We used to have a lot of fishing happened in our community up until maybe 1980, our local lakes have become so polluted due to agricultural runoff and also raw sewage being released by surrounding cities into our water system. So we've lost a lot of that due to that. But yeah, I mean, you know, a lot of the other fellows who are hunters here in our community, they might hunt, but they're not hunting for the same reasons that I might be hunting. Mm. I see a lot of them have adopted sort of Americana version of hunting, trophy hunting, you know, looking for the big buck. Mm-hmm. They watch the Hunting Channel, and this is where they've learned their hunting skills and implemented them, because we kind of had a lost generation there. I think a lot of in my father's generation, it really hit rock bottom, where nobody was keeping that alive and well. And so in our generation, you see people getting back into it, but some of them aren't getting back into it for the same reasons. And for me, they're fundamentally different. They're very different, and they encourage a very different worldview.
Hmm. There are some conversations, like, so I'm just thinking back about to this idea of food sovereignty. There are some that will say that wild food is a privilege for various reasons like not everyone has access to wild spaces or access to knowledge about them. And then there's a perspective that taking from the wilderness puts everyone else at risk because of the idea that like the wild should stay wild. And then I guess maybe humans in human spaces should stay human. I'm not exactly sure of all the nuances of the arguments and maybe other reasons too. I'm very interested in your perspective, being influenced by your relationship and more recent historical relationship with the land. And so I would like to hear you and your voice on the matter.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, it gets into discussions around privilege, sustainability, you know, does the natural world, is it able to provide for humanity at this, as we now head towards 8 billion people? Yeah. I mean, I don't have the solutions for all of humanity,
right?
You know, and I always think of ecosystems. I mean, the planet was a huge and diverse planet with so many different ecosystems, and the cultures, the human cultures reflected that. The diversity in human cultures reflected that. And the big elephant in the room is monoculture, whether it's monocrops or it's, you know, the melting pot of monoculture in humanity. I know that so many see that as an honorable pursuit, but myself, I'm very leery of that. I see great danger in pursuing monoculture. Diversity is key to resilience as human beings. So I think there's many different answers for different peoples where they are. Mm-hmm. And the solutions going forward are going to be very diverse. You know, where I live now, present day, the province of Saskatchewan, I mean, you know, we're the size of California, Oregon, and Washington put together. And there's only 1 million people there or here in that massive space. And we have 2/3 of that is boreal forest. So, you know, we do have a different reality than, say, those people living in California, as far as how much our natural systems can carry us forward. So I think for myself as an Indigenous person, though, and this is something that gets lost in, I think, a lot of conversations when it comes to protecting land, you know, something people should be familiar with is the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And when it comes around who has first right of access to maintaining a land-based lifestyle, the hunting and gathering, I don't see the capacity for everybody, and it's not a reality for everybody to live that lifestyle. But as Indigenous peoples, we certainly have a right to continue. Here in Canada, we certainly do have that right to hunt, to fish, to gather year-round. We don't have to adhere by hunting seasons. But of course, that's always under threat. And so there's always pressure from mainstream society to eliminate that. I think that's that is always this pressure to assimilate, to do away with our way of life, which essentially is genocide. That's cultural genocide, mm-hmm. You know. And when if you want to do away with that land-based lifestyle, you essentially would be reducing our cultural practices just down to very shallow spectacles of entertainment, you know, dressing up and dancing at a powwow, but it really has no spiritual or ecological substance. And if we remove ourselves as Indigenous peoples from our actual ecological function, you know, we are key species on this continent, just like the bison were. You know, the bison and Indigenous peoples were a part of the reciprocal relationship that actually made grasslands healthy here on the plains. You know, with both Indigenous peoples and the bison being removed, you know, we find ourselves, you know, society finds themselves searching for all sorts of ways to try to maintain grassland health, but with cattle and, you know, rotational grazing and these sorts of things. But I think that when you remove Indigenous peoples from the ecosystems that they emerged from, it's inevitable that ecosystem will collapse, and so will that Indigenous human culture. It'll collapse. So it's very important that we try to bring those connections back together for the betterment of all of us, really.
Right.
Maybe I went off topic there.
No, I don't think so. I don't think it's off topic. I think that what happens is these are super complex issues, and we're so used to talking about food over here and language over here and human rights over here and ecology over here. And it's become so parsed that we kind of forget that it's all, there's just one system. Like, it's just,
you're right,
one thing, yeah, happening with so many moving parts that it's so complicated that the tendency is just to think of global solutions, you know, and to recognize the wholeness of it, of something, is also dependent on the wholeness of each of the parts. And that, I guess what I most appreciate about your answer, so no, it wasn't off topic at all, I think, is this idea again that there's an idea that equality would mean like the single solution for everyone to have exactly the same thing throughout the globe. And what I hear you expressing, I believe, not to put words in your mouth, would be that the needs are local to the ecosystems, and you can define local, I guess, at lots of different levels, that it's that complicated to keep thinking about it. And I also think it's really, just to tie in what you just said now to what you said earlier, this idea that language is springing forth, culture is springing forth from a local ecosystem, that this diversity that you see throughout the world includes the language and the cultures and the landscapes and the way people interact with the landscapes, that it's all tied together, and that preservation of culture indeed requires preservation of the relationships that caused it to express, perhaps. Mm-hmm. It reminds me of another conversation. It seems like we had a lot of conversations when we were together, but we were talking about tobacco. So you're talking about not wanting to reduce a culture to maybe the symbolic, like the symbols, sure, of a culture, but the behaviors, and you were talking about tobacco. And of course, I am interested in, my personal practices include like 30 and 40 mile walks, you know, like these things where I feel like this is how I relate to my landscape, is to like physically walk across it. And you were talking about, I guess, the spiritual practice of exchanging tobacco, but it being relating to the work that one had to do to gather it. And if you could share some of that, I think that would help solidify for people listening who, I would say the bulk of our listeners are not Indigenous peoples. And the idea, the idea of like what is a spiritual practice? I mean, everyone has their own spiritual practices, but like, let's talk about tobacco. What is that relationship with tobacco, the exchange of it? What does all of it entail, you know, in a few minutes?
Right, sure. Well, you know, you have diversity of different linguistic Indigenous groups throughout North America, but I think the majority of us, we do all have a common relationship with tobacco or some sort of form of tobacco. Here on the Northern Plains, we didn't actually use a tobacco plant. We never had a tobacco plant, but we made a tobacco, a smoking blend used in our pipes. And we would use, we call it kniknik, which is bearberry, a bearberry leaf. And then that would be sort of the base. And then you'd also the inner bark of a red willow tree. And then other plant medicines added to that. So the procurement of that was very labor intensive. And it would also involve travel and sometimes trade in some instances, because and you would see variety too, depending on where you are, you know, how far north you were, you know, you're going to see diversity in that tobacco blend, depending on people's surrounding flora and fauna, right? But yeah, tobacco is always the center trade item. But when I say trade item, I mean in buying, purchasing anything from, you know, just in a modern sense. I mean, if I was to go to an elder and I want to learn a song, a traditional song, I would, first and foremost, is tobacco. You know, tobacco has to be offered. And the amount, you know, now has changed, because now you buy a packet of cigarettes or a packet of a pouch of tobacco. But traditionally, it would just be enough to fill a bowl of a pipe, because that interaction that you would share with one another would commence with a pipe ceremony. And so that tobacco would be offered for the prayers to commence that interaction. So yeah, tobacco is a very sacred tool that we use. But I've been interested in exploring, you know, what is lost, right, in that process that we had traditionally of procuring that tobacco, you know, the amount of walking that went into it. And as Indigenous peoples, whenever we are on the land doing something, whether it's hunting, whether it's picking medicines, there is also a massive amount of oral knowledge that goes along with it. There is creation stories that go along with that activity. There is songs that go with that activity. There are specific prayers that go with that activity. So when we remove ourselves from that actual land-based lifestyle of gathering, the knowledge and the stories and the songs begin to fall away as well. And, you know, when I talk about giving value to something, giving spiritual power and value to that handful of tobacco, it would have been infused with that power through the labor that that person went to gather it, and through the songs and prayers that they had infused into that tobacco. So when it arrived as destination, it had great value. Where now today, you know, so many people, we just look to convenience and we only see the surface of things. We don't put any deep thought into or action into the procurement of the items. I mean, this convenience culture where, you know, you run to the corner store and you grab a pack of cigarettes and then you go to go see an elder and you're like, okay, can I get this song from you? You know, so much has been lost in that, right? And I think that we sell ourselves short to just say, you know, we can exchange one for the other, you know. They're fundamentally different.
Yeah, it's a difference between a vitamin C tablet and an orange.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, you need the fiber, right? I mean, and you need the substance. And
even the work to pick it or the knowledge of how to plant it.
Well, and this is how it relates all back to natural movement, right? Because we actually, the consequence of this is we see it affecting our bodies. You know, the obesity epidemic in First Nations communities is astronomical, and diabetes, early onset diabetes in our children. In fact, I think our stat here, children born in the year 2000, which are, so they're now becoming young adults, you know, 18 years old, 2 out of 3 are expected to have diabetes before the age of 40. Mm. You know, an example of this too, I mean, I took a group of boys, grade 5, 10 and 11-year-old boys. I had 9 of them. I took them out to on a trap line, snaring rabbits. 4 out of the 9 were too obese to even walk for more than 4 or 5 minutes in the snow and over the deadfall, and simply had to return back to the van. This is the reality of our people. This is the reality, and this is the effect of being dispossessed from a land-based lifestyle.
Yes. It's interesting, you know, in the realms in which I work, there's this, you know, a resonating idea that, you know, movement and you know, land-based practices, although I'm not sure that you would read that terminology, are in our DNA. And then, of course, when you've had people removed from the land for a longer period of time, hundreds and thousands of years, you kind of adapt to not needing those inputs as much as a culture like yours, so recently removed from the land. I think that was maybe one of the first conversations that we had, where the consequences are so much. They're so different for populations being forcefully, actively displaced. And I'm trying to point out convenience and sedentarism, the relationship of that. And at first glance, it's because of health. You know, we can talk about things like diabetes and survival statistics, but ultimately, I'm very interested in movement ecology. And what happens when you have masses of people becoming sedentary? How does that relate to cultural diversity? You know, how does my belief that I have entitlement, a privilege of sedentarism, ultimately start encroaching on others? Like, these are more complex questions, but it really is my personal evolution and my relationship to movement, from my personal health to the health and well-being of others. And that's really only a commentary to maybe for the listeners to tie in so much of my work to maybe some of the things that you are speaking of. Your things that you're speaking of alone are super important. I mean, are like of such greater importance than I would say the way my knees and my hips feel. But just to kind of give people a sense of sedentarism and a lack of being able to move in a natural world is, I think, a really so much more important thing than our personal health. You know what I mean? I guess if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, you bet. Yeah, no, I say it's always, you know, in our traditional teachings, you know, the first, never be human-centric. And right. This is what Western society is all about, human-centricity. You know, when we talk about climate change, or we talk about, you know, how's this going to affect, I always see this, people saying the same things, you know, how's this going to affect human beings? How's this, you know, I'm like, well, we have to stop just thinking about human beings. We have to think about the planet holistically, you know, all life, life systems, you know, and that of course comes back to us. But in our teachings, you know, we put human beings at the bottom. We have something called Wakotowin. Wakotowin is a loose, very shallow translation is kinship, but it's actually, there's a lot of complex protocols. Wakotowin, you know, it kind of governs family and tribal relationships between people, but it also recognizes our relationships with all of our life relatives, all the animal world, the plant world, the medicine world, everything. Recognizing the ecosystem that you live in and how it functions, observing how it functions, understanding the roles and relationships between all of those different life forms in that ecosystem, figuring out where do we fit in, what role do we play in the health and well-being of the function of that ecosystem, and therefore we acclimate to its caring capacity. That's the definition of an indigenous culture. Mm. That's indigenous peoples. And so as we would enter and migrate into a new territory, we would be very highly observant of that caring capacity and in the relationships with it, and always place ourselves at the bottom and say, as long as we respect and take care of this ecosystem's natural function, it will always take care of us forever going forward. That's sustainability, where you take the human-centric Western worldview of dominance to, you know, to put something under the plow and to essentially obliterate an ecosystem for human consumption needs, you know, that are, it's, so we see this now, you know, where, you know, the grasslands of North America, you know, 90% of it has been turned into, you know, monocrops that are sprayed with insecticides.
Right.
So, you know, what has been lost in that, it's been absolutely devastating, and it's ongoing devastation to human cultures and to the function what did those natural grasslands, what was their role in carbon sequestration and everything else and the function of the planet? So we always have to look bigger than our own needs.
Yeah. And our own desires, preference, like personal preferences.
Well, yeah, you bet. Yeah.
So here's my question. My last question for you is, how is your work, what you'd like to accomplish, what you and your community require, how is that best supported by non-Indigenous folks?
Well, there again, diversity is key, right? You know, get to know Indigenous peoples in whatever territory you're living in. Mm. You know, their needs on the coast where you are going to be very different than the needs of my community. That's the first rule, I guess. And then also the importance of not being rescuers or not being coming in into an Indigenous community and saying, hey, I can see what your guys' problem is and I know how to fix it. We've had that for a century. Mm-hmm. And it always falls flat. I think that there's a lot of very smart young Indigenous peoples in communities all across North America. They know what they need, but they're lacking the means. As we know, most of the wealth in the U.S. and in Canada, you know, is in the hands of non-Indigenous and not people of color still hold that power and wealth. And so, you know, just supporting what other initiatives that are already happening, I think is important, that are Indigenous led.
Do you have a couple good examples? I mean, we can put them in the show notes and point people directly to, you know, great Indigenous led.
Yeah, well,
local community or even on a larger scale, climate work.
I think climate work is really important, and I think anybody who's doing food sovereignty. Mm. I mean, there's all kinds of food sovereignty. It's food sovereignty, like I was saying. I mean, that's the core.
Right.
It's the core. Everything else, you know, when you're putting food sovereignty and issues back together, that begins to heal the social fabric of a community. That brings back the language. That brings back economic prosperity. That brings back that begins to heal all of that that's been frayed. And so for myself, that's where I see the most focus is needed in those food sovereignty initiatives. And I bet you in the U.S., every major reservation is going to have a fairly good-sized community of people very conscious of that and moving forward with that. I know there's a lot of conferences, even more so in the U.S. than there is in Canada, around food sovereignty. In fact, I think there's one in your area very soon.
There is, coming in Seattle, up. Where it is.
In Seattle, mm-hmm. Yeah. And then I think there's another one coming up in Iowa, another one in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. So yeah, I think that that's a really good thing to be supporting. Here for myself, like locally, I've partnered with the Nature Conservancy of Canada. Here, like we've had the whole truth and reconciliation process happening, although it's very controversial. You know, it's all stemming from the residential school systems, but we had the Truth and Reconciliation Commission come out with, I believe, 94 recommendations for both government and NGO organizations to take on in a healing process going forward with Indigenous peoples in this country. I couldn't list them all. You could Google it, TRC recommendations, you know, but different organizations might be able to just say adopt one or two, mm-hmm. you know. And so the Nature Conservancy of Canada, because they have land, they have, you know, here in Saskatchewan, they have, I believe, 150,000 acres of natural prairie. They said, well, how do we, you know, what role has the dispossession of from the land has, what role has that played in Indigenous communities? So how can we be of service? So going forward, I'll be working with them, doing some contract work, exploring some land-based education opportunities, getting, you know, First Nation schools, kids out onto natural prairie. They have buffalo. They have some massive buffalo herds in some of their bigger properties in the south of the province. And they want to do partnerships with Indigenous communities with raising buffalo. They also want to do, you know, food sovereignty initiatives. Just really exploring. Right now, we're very early days and exploring, you know, what all can we do? And over the next year, I'll probably be going out to communities throughout the province, First Nations communities, on behalf of the NCC, sort of letting some of our people know, you know, about the NCC and what sort of work they are able to do. But they're also, you know, taking that approach of letting First Nations persons like myself, let's go to the communities, let's see what they could do, how can they be of support? You know, they're not prescribing a solution themselves. Mm. They're just saying, hey, we have land. How can it be of use?
Well, thank you for all of that. Those are many, many action items. So I appreciate that. And I also appreciate you taking your time away from your much more important work than being on my podcast to come and share your perspective and inform many. Hopefully it will trickle back ultimately to the work that you are trying to accomplish. So I just want to say I'm grateful that you've come on, and I thank you for all the work that you're doing.
Yeah, well, I'm very honored. And no, it's all important work. Thank you very much.
Philip Brass is a member of the Peipekasis First Nation in the Treaty 4 Territory of Canada. He is a dedicated husband and father and traditional knowledge carrier. He is a strong and emerging voice in the areas of Indigenous food sovereignty, land-based education, climate action, community health, natural movement, and traditional Indigenous knowledge and wisdom. If you want to make a donation to support Philip's work, he's working with the Nature Conservancy of Canada to develop a number of land-based initiatives. You can donate directly to the Saskatchewan office of the Nature Conservancy of Canada. He's collaborating with Jennifer McKillop there, and we'll put a link to contact her in our show notes. Oh, Canada, I will be in you. Or is it on you very soon? I am headed to Victoria and Vancouver in lovely British Columbia next week. And then I'll be heading off to Europe for a bunch of dates in Scotland, England, Germany, Spain, and Italy. There are spaces in my events in Germany, Spain, and Italy. Everything else is full. I'm sorry. I'm leading a barefoot experience in one of the many Barfuss parks, barefoot parks in that country. It is a family-friendly event, and I'd love to see you there. And then, you have to check this out. In Italy, I'm so stoked about this. I am doing the book launch for the Italian translation of Move Your DNA in this entirely handmade and human-powered amusement park in Treviso, or probably something like Treviso. As in no electricity, as in all of the rides, you have to work to get it to do what it's supposed to do. So there's a link to all of the events in the show notes. You can also find more on my live events link on the calendar on nutritiousmovement.com. We will link to the Barefoot Park and the amusement park. because even if you never get there yourself in person, you have to check them out online. Spectacular. So thank you all. For more information, visit nutritiousmovement.com and sign up for my newsletter. Come say hi on social media. I post movement tips almost daily on Instagram/nutritiousmovement. If you have a question or if there's something you'd like to know, email podcast@nutritiousmovement.com. And if you enjoy listening to Move Your DNA, please consider leaving us a review on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. Your review helps other listeners decide whether they should take a chance on listening. On behalf of everyone at Move Your DNA and Nutritious Movement, thank you for listening. We appreciate your support.
This has been Move Your DNA with Katie Bowman, a podcast about movement. Hopefully you find the general information in this podcast informative and helpful, but it is not intended to replace medical advice and should not be used as such.